You're listening to the Dr. Nina Show with Dr. Nina Savelle Rocklin, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hey there, welcome to the Dr. Nina Show here on LA Talk Radio. I'm your host, Dr. Nina Savelle Rocklin. I am here to help you stop counting calories, carbs, and fat grams. Stop dieting so you can easily lose weight and get to a happy place in your life, a happier, healthier relationship with food. And that means getting on with your life and waking up and thinking about your day, not your diet. If you'd like to talk with me today, then the call-in number here is 818-570-5085. 818-570-5085. I would love to hear what is on your mind, what is eating at you, because the real problem with binge eating, stress eating, and any kind of emotional eating, the real problem is not food. The real problem is not what you're eating, it's what's eating at you. And by the way, feel free to call me anytime. Do not worry about interrupting me if I am mid-sentence. I want to hear from you. Okay, so again, not what you're eating that's the problem, it's what's eating at you. And one of the most common underlying triggers to binge eating, stress eating, any kind of emotional eating, one of the biggest triggers is the experience of shame. And shame is one of those words that's it's used a lot. It's used interchangeably with guilt. But there is a huge, huge difference. And this is something that I talk about in my book. So I'm just going to read a little bit about that. And then I'm going to get to more specifically about shame, talking about shame and talking about it in the context of this incredible book by my friend and colleague, Dr. Alita Edwards, called Fear of the Abyss. We're going to get to that soon. So shame. Guilt is different from shame, which is about who you are as a person. Guilt is you feel bad for something that you've done or something that you haven't done. Shame has to do with your essential character. Whereas guilt sounds like, oh, there's something wrong with what I did. Shame sounds like there's something really wrong with me. So I was really bad last night. I ate pizza and cookies. You might say something like that. And if you feel guilty and or ashamed for eating, you know, what crimes are you accusing yourself of? If you feel good when you eat healthy food and bad when you eat something you think you should not have eaten, then your sense of self is overly tied to food. And if you feel shame for eating pizza or ice cream or whatever with however many carbs, stop and ask yourself, you know, why? Why did I do it? By the way, there is not anything inherently wrong or shameful about eating those kinds of junk foods. If you eat something decadent every once in a while, you should enjoy it. That's great. So shame is really an intrinsic sense of there is something wrong with you, something indefinably or sometimes definably bad about you. And so, you know, one of the things that I hear a lot is people say they feel shame just for having feelings. They're ashamed of their feelings. There's a lot of shame involved in vulnerability, for example. Which is a feeling is just a reaction to a situation, but our culture treats it as if it's a character flaw. You know, in fact, almost everyone who comes to see me seeks treatment from me, whether it's my private practice or my inner circle group coaching program. Anyone who comes to see me, they tell me they are too emotional, that they are too dramatic, too sensitive, too much, and they feel a lot of shame about this. Why is that? Because there is nothing more humiliating and shaming as reacting to something, you know, when you react to something hurtful or upsetting, and people label you as sensitive or too much. You have this feeling, and instead of people responding to your feelings, they observe you, they scrutinize you, and they tell you you're too sensitive, instead of saying, what's hurting you? What's bothering you? Tell me what's on your mind. So one of my friends and colleagues, Dr. Alita Edwards, has written a book, and she describes people who deal with issues of control, shame, perfectionism, the anxiety that goes with it. She helps you understand why you may be preoccupied with perfectionism, control, and shame. And she connects how past events, including and especially, you know, meaning trauma, influence your perception of yourself and others. And in the book, again, it's called Fear of the Abyss. If you're watching me right now rather than listening to me, you can, here it is. She offers writing exercises that create change by getting to that proverbial root of shame rather than focusing on the experience of shame and what to do about it only. So, you know, I'm all about that emotional gardening. You got to get to the root. You pull up the weed, it's just going to grow back. You have to deal with what is often hidden from you, which is why I love the root analogy. We can't see the root, but we know it's there because it creates the weed. We have unconscious motivations, something that is hidden from us often. We know it's there because it creates these behaviors. So, you know, this book is right up my alley, and I'd like to read a little bit about from this book. So, you know, let me know what resonates with you as I go. I also told Dr. Edwards that I would be talking about the book today, so who knows? She may just be calling in, so we may hear from her as we talk about shame. So this is what she says. She talks about what she calls the PCS personality, people who are very much involved in perfectionism, control, shame. They deal with issues of perfectionism, control, and shame. She says, sadly, just about everyone at some point or another has experienced humiliation. Shame hurts so much that we find it hard to even think about it. And then we dedicate intense effort to making sure it never happens again. Everyone has gone through something that for them was very painful and shame-inducing. And in my experience and her experience, the best way to deal with shame is to face it, to take the dread and power out of the memory. It is not pleasant to do this. That's for sure, Alita. That is for sure. It is not pleasant. It is not easy. But it is necessary. She says the rewards are great. Shame is a strange emotion. It thrives on secrecy, but when it's held up to the light, it tends to wither and die. Many people with the PCS personality traits, that's again, perfectionism, control, and shame, have a deep sense of shame so powerful that they can't even say why something would be so devastating to them. Again, out of awareness, but not out of operation. Hidden, unconscious. We want to bring what's unconscious into consciousness. So back to her. She says, for many of us, there have been painful times in life when our dignity was under attack. And it's crucial to face those memories in order to move on. Shame is, in fact, the terrible feeling we experience when our dignity is attacked and we believe it is taken from us. However, she says, both her general life experience and experience as a psychologist have shown her that dignity is not something that can actually be taken away from someone. She says dignity is inherent and is our birthright. And as an example, she says she has many clients who were just abused and as I have, you know, as everyone in this field has, terrible abuse, verbal, physical, emotional. And again, when people are abused or neglected or just there's a misattunement, and it's horrible to grow up in a family where you feel like the people who are there to raise you just on a profound level do not understand you. Even something like a misattunement, so that when you feel something, they label you as too emotional. That can be devastating. So when you have these psychological experiences, ruptures, these painful experiences with people become unsafe. And food is safe. Food, which represents people in our psyche. Again, we don't consciously think of it that way, but it is there. It is part of our unconscious equivalency. Food equals nurturing. Comfort food means we want to be comforted by another person. So if we can't turn to people because people are unreliable or unpredictable or unavailable, guess what? Food is always there. It is reliable, it is predictable, and it is available. You're never going to have a piece of pizza and have it taste like a cucumber. You know, you're never going to have chocolate ice cream and suddenly it tastes like a turnip. This is the weirdest combinations I can come up with. But you know what I mean. And it's available. People are not always there when you want them or need them if you let yourself need them. Some people can't let themselves need other people, so they have a relationship with food or their bodies instead. But if you want people, if you want connection, if you want relationship on some level, and it's not available, you're going to turn to food instead. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. You're on with Dr. Nina.
Hi, this is Alita.
Alita. Hey, everyone. I've got Dr. Alita Edwards on the phone with me. I'm so glad you called. I don't know if you were following the show, but I was just talking about your book and about the experience of shame.
Yes, I am following, and I agree with everything you said about food always being there, and how awful.
Uh-oh. Alita, we just lost you. Are you there? Alita?
Yeah, sorry. Another call came in. And
oh, okay. All right, you're back.
I'm back.
So tell me, how did you first get interested in the idea of this personality constellation, of which shame is just one of them, the trio of experiences that lead to this personality? What made you identify, hey, shame is one of the core issues here, and perfectionism and control really go along with that?
I think it's because I was specializing in anxiety and depression, and shame is something that seems to manifest in so many different ways. It can be disordered eating, it can be depression, it can be panic, it can be social anxiety. So one thing I started to notice, seeing people who would come in with complaints that seemed very different, but what they were all experiencing was what they called not being able to control something that might be unpredictable, a fear of someone judging them. And what it all boiled down to was, more on the surface, a feeling of not being adequate, of not being good enough, and under that, of how bad they really did feel. So they created these traits to try to keep that terrible shame out of awareness. And by its very nature, I noticed that no matter how much people are suffering, they'll do pretty much anything to avoid the shame. And, you know, that makes sense. We all try to avoid painful feelings.
Or create mastery over it by shaming ourselves.
Yes. Yes. And, you know, one thing, this is very important to me, I'm sure as an analyst it is to you too, but when you said you'd like to get to the root, I feel that very, very strongly, because a lot of clients that I've had therapy, and they had been in group therapy and individual therapy, and they're saying to themselves during the day, you know, it's okay not to be perfect and I'm good enough. And they would come and say, I'm saying this 100 times a day. Why do I need to keep doing this?
I love that.
I don't really.
That reminds me of people who come in and they say, well, I'm failing at mantras. I'm failing at self-love because I can't talk myself into feeling a different way. And that's because, of course, you can say it 1,000,000,000 times that you are free of shame and a lovely, wonderful, good person deserving of love. But if you don't believe it at some core level, of course, no matter how much you tell yourself something, you're not going to believe it. So what I love about the book is that you have so many examples of people who go under the surface, another way to think about the unconscious, to figure out how they came to have that relationship to themselves, how they came to avoid shame through perfectionism and control.
Yes, and to keep up the perfectionism involves so much work too. So what happened, to get back to your question, how did I notice there were a constellation of traits? When people would come in, they'd say, oh, I have this panic now, and I never had it before. So, of course, I'm asking them, well, why now? What happened? But when you're in a state of panic, you can't think so well. So I would say, have you had a disappointment recently? Because dealing with disappointing others or being disappointed, that's part of the constellation of shame. And they would start to cry and say yes. They were frozen. Some of these were young adults. There was something their parents wanted them to do, and they didn't want that. They wanted something different. So they, which to them is very shameful, very shameful. And when I saw how difficult it was for people, because, you know, Nina, we really, a lot of what we do is to build trust and make a safe environment for people to talk about things. But shame is so strong that I wrote this book so that people could have privacy with getting comfortable with facing it, and then bring it to therapy and go further.
And I so appreciate some of the unique aspects of your book, which is, of course, why I love it. And one of the things that, you know, what you just talked about, disappointment, it is so much easier to be disappointed in ourselves. For example, you know, what would pertain to my listeners here, be disappointed in yourself for what you ate or what you weigh, than it is to be disappointed in someone else. And this kind of turning against the self is so prevalent, and so that's why people learn to self-shame rather than to experience the humiliating experience of being shamed by others. They do it to themselves.
They do, and, you know, I joke around with my clients. I call it the hard set. I say, now when you face this, you'll just feel sad. You know, you won't feel anxious, and it's become our little joke. But the truth is, when you face it, you do face something sad, and you process it, and you're not so much bothered by this anymore. And that's the truth. I think there's like an expectation that people have developed to counteract that self-dislike, where even their thoughts are supposed to be perfect.
Yes.
And we're not made that way, you know.
Great point. What is perfect? Do we know?
Right.
What is perfect?
Yeah. I always tell people, no one could stand you if you really were. You know, it's true. It's people's flaws that make them endearing, and we all have them.
Yeah. I remember I was once at this restaurant, doesn't exist anymore, called Stevie's, and it was this Creole restaurant, and every Friday night they would have like a jazz band, and if it was your birthday you could get on stage and dance with the band, and they'd play you this soulful, funky, happy birthday song. And one day there were like four people who got on the stage, three just, you know, people, and one perfect looking person, like she looked like Barbie. I mean, and I say perfect in a slightly facetious way. I mean, she looked very surgeried, and everything was in place, not a hair out of place, perfect body, fake boobs looking, and like just like she looked like what she thought perfect was supposed to look like, if that makes sense. And when the music started, she was so uncomfortable with herself that it was almost painful to watch her attempt to move her body and dance. It was so, it was like I felt embarrassed for her. Whereas all the other three people just were dancing, and they were delightful to watch because they exuded this happiness, this energy, and I always remember that. You have to be comfortable with yourself, because if not, it's going to show. It's going to exude out of you. But when you are comfortable with yourself and your imperfections and the exigencies of life, then that also surrounds you.
That's a wonderful example. It really is. Shame is almost like having a tight band around yourself. It's such an inhibitor. And, you know, part of the consolation is the ability to fantasize. A lot of people feel like, well, who am I to fantasize having this great job? Even there, it inhibits so much. And feel free is just a beautiful feeling.
Yes, I feeling free, I like to say, because I specialize in eating disorders, and the big word around eating disorders is eating disorder recovery. And I hate that word. I absolutely loathe that word, because recovery, we recover from the flu. We recover from a bad breakup. Yeah. And people say to me all the time, I'm always going to have to deal with this. I know. And I say, no, you can liberate yourself from this. You can free yourself from this. Because when you get to why you are eating and address that, and shame is so often part of it, I would say almost always, then you're free and you can just live your life. That's when you get up and think about your day, not your diet. So I just appreciate what you write in the book, because it addresses so many of the different aspects of that which torture people, you know, not being able to be disappointed in others, so being or in situations or in the world, so being disappointed in themselves. Shame, turning against themselves, trying to be perfect so they don't feel shame. I mean, it's just so it's just so beautifully articulated. And I especially like the fact that you give people exercises. What's your favorite exercise that you tell people to do?
I think my favorite exercise, and it's not right there at the beginning. There are, you know, like warm-up exercises. But my favorite exercise is when it says, write down, because I suggest keeping a journal, what was something embarrassing that happened to you once? Mm-hmm. And I like that one, because I feel like, and this is what people who've written me tell me, that once they write it down or just think it through, that it's not as bad as it was before. So I love that exercise, because once they do it, there's a little surprise at the end that some of the weight is lifted off.
Yeah, and you make the point that shame is so often tied to secrecy. And when it's not a secret, and when you can write it down and maybe share it with somebody else, or think about, what if this had happened to somebody else? Would you be mortified for them? Or is it less egregious? It does mitigate that awfulness of shame.
Yeah, I think it does. And it's really a terrible problem, because by definition, people really don't want to talk about it. But I was thinking, the people that struggle with disordered eating, I think they're very insightful people, because to me, the reason I call the book Fear of the Abyss is a specific problem with somebody's self-image, which with how they think of themselves because of their experience. And I think people that struggle with eating have gotten closer, they know it's a problem with how they see themselves. With other manifestations, they don't know that yet. And I think with the eating, people think, oh, the problem must be with my body. It's really not. But I feel like at least they know they have a problem with how they think of themselves.
And yes, I absolutely agree. And there's also something about the abyss, the void that is there when you can't relate to yourself in a loving, nurturing, accepting way. There's a void that's there. I guess that would be the word that I use, and maybe that's related to your idea of the abyss, sort of emptiness, where there should be a sense of self.
Yes, absolutely. And I think, you know, it's been my experience, my gosh, that's 30 years now, but the people that have this shame are very kind, nice people. And I always say to them, as you face more and more of yourself, I think you're going to like who you find. And they do, because there's a very good person there. A very good person. But they've been shamed for things that don't really make you good or bad. They've been shamed for silly, irrelevant things. And they've taken this in. And it's, you know, I've had clients that felt intense shame if they didn't clean their apartment. And I'm like, you might get embarrassed if someone pops over, but this doesn't make you bad. It's your apartment. You know, clean it when you want to. So I think a lot of times people just really take things in, and they are good, kind people, and they somehow have been taught through experience that goodness and kindness don't really matter as much as what they look like, as being perfect, as not making mistakes, and they'll do everything to avoid that. They can't challenge those values until they face how they feel.
And what's lovely about the book is that you help people understand why they developed this relationship to themselves. And I think so many people who struggle with food can completely fit into this constellation, you know, perfectionism, shame, and control. And when you help people realize, well, how did they come to organize themselves in this way? It's something they learned, right? It's something you learned. You didn't grow up just automatically feeling bad about yourself. You know, kids feel great about themselves. They laugh, they giggle, they feel free, and then it's only when they have those shaming experiences that they develop this. And so it's so healthy that you make the point, hey, you essentially learned this way of relating to yourself, and you can unlearn it and learn something new. So it's profound, but it's identifying, well, what is it? You know, what is that you learn? Where do these ideas come from? Rather than addressing the symptoms of it, which is unfortunately so much in our managed care system now. Don't even get me started. That's what people are doing. So getting to the roots, and I guess to carry the metaphor further, planting new seeds.
Yes, that's a good one. That's a very good one. And it certainly can be done. It certainly can. And, I wrote it. I see one person at a time. There are a lot of people with shame all over, regardless of culture or gender or how it presents. And I really wanted to do something to lighten that up. Because I hate shame. It just causes so much suffering.
Well, I am...
Oh,
sorry, go on.
No, that was really the reason I did it. I wanted to take a chunk out of that shame.
And you did so...
That they could,
You did so beautifully.
Well, thank you.
I just want to say there's this one part where you talk about the woman who was paralyzed in the nursing home, and she was just lying in bed all day. She had no family, no friends. She needed help with everything, and there were times when people, the nurses, would be rushed or sharp or just kind of not treat her the best. And that she said she would remember that while she lived in her body, she was not just her body. And that invisible though she may be to some people and unable to care for herself, she was a good and worthy human being. She'd suffered terribly, but she was in touch with her own dignity. So in all her suffering, she did not suffer shame. And the connection that you make between dignity and shame is also really profound. So I just want to thank you, Dr. Alida Edwards, for writing this book. Again, it's called Fear of the Abyss, Healing the Wounds of Shame and Perfectionism. Dr. Alida Edwards, you can get it on Amazon and in bookstores, and I highly recommend it. It's also, Alida, the other thing I really love about this book is it is relatable and personable. I felt as if you were just talking to me like we're talking on this show. It didn't feel like this, you know, scary psychological treatise. It felt like, oh, let me help. It felt like you were sort of just warm and understanding and saying, hey, here's how you came to feel this way, and here's what you can do, and here's another way to think.
Well, it's funny. I did write the way I talk because I'm not a formal person, and I don't really like formality very much. So I wanted to write like I was there with the person, and I had, you know, so many wonderful clients in my mind, and I was just, I really did feel in touch with people. I really did. And I just wanted them to see and feel their own dignity and to be talked to that way. Not talked to. I mean, it's a book after all, but that's how I thought about it.
That's how it comes off.
I wanted...
Yeah, like you're talking to the reader. You're talking to the reader. You're talking with the reader almost, rather than at the reader, which I especially appreciate. And you have so much to say. So thank you for writing this book, and thank you for calling in to talk about this book. And it's really wonderful, guys. If you get a chance, Fear of the Abyss, Healing the Wounds of Shame and Perfectionism, and I think you're going to find it incredibly helpful. It is not written specifically for people who struggle with food, but it is actually almost anyone who struggles with food can relate to this book. So I think you're going to love it.
Well, it was good to talk with you, and thank you for discussing the book.
Thank you for calling in and discussing the book. It was an absolute pleasure, and I'm so glad that you did.
All right. Well, take care. I love your show.
Thank you. Bye. Bye for now.
Bye.
Bye. Oh, so helpful. Yeah, I mean, the idea of shame is so pervasive and needs to really be, we need to eradicate shame, because shame is at the root of so many really harmful behaviors, self-harm or just negative self-esteem and all of that. You can't simultaneously feel good about yourself and feel a sense of shame. So let me know if you have any questions, what you think about my conversation with Alida, Dr. Edwards, what you have yourself experienced in terms of shame. Again, the number is 818-570-5085. So I am going to keep talking about binge eating disorder. I had talked about how food addiction was really not a thing. It's really eating addiction, if we're going to use the term addiction. And in the last show, I talked about how It's the use of food, turning to food for comfort, distraction, numbing, filling a void, many, many, many different ways that food is unconsciously used. And one of them is about, one of them is fun, right? If you do not have enough fun in your life, I was talking about Belinda, who had a job she didn't like, and she was stuck in this marriage, and she was stuck in this religious community where she had to kind of conform, and she just felt so stuck in her life. And she felt as if she was addicted to cookie dough. She called it her personal crack. Sugar is her personal crack. And by the time that we worked through that, she could have a cookie and not even think about it. She could make cookies with her daughter, and whereas she previously would send this kid out of the kitchen on some, you know, she'd think of some excuse to get the kid out of the kitchen, and she'd eat a bunch of cookie dough. By the time we worked through everything that was going on with her, she could just make cookies with her daughter. She didn't feel that pull to the cookie dough. She could have a cookie or two without having to have more, without shame. And there were many reasons why, but one of the reasons that we got to, not the primary reason, but food was fun. Belinda was not having enough fun in her life. And so, you know, if you're not having enough fun, you're overly reliant on food for fun. So the more fun you have, the less likely you are to use food for fun. So when Belinda really changed her life, all of that changed. Okay. So next we're going to talk about body language. So binging is also a means of expressing, comforting, or enacting conflicts that may or may not be in your conscious awareness. Again, they're out of awareness, but not out of operation. They're hidden from you. You can't fight what you can't see. So whatever is going on with food, it can express what you can't express in words or what you can't express in thoughts. And so translating the language of the body into words, helping you understand what underlying emotions, fears, wishes, or conflicts are going on, what's getting expressed through food, then you can deal, then you know what you're fighting for. Then you can deal with it. You can understand yourself on a deeper level, and you can totally create a shift in the way that you relate to yourself and give up that eating disorder behavior just automatically because you stopped thinking about it. It's not about willpower. So as an example, Emily, who had gained and lost 30 pounds repeatedly throughout her life, said she gained at least 300 pounds in total over her lifetime since she went on her first diet at age 10. And she always said, oh, well, I always found those lost pounds. And now Emily was doing great in other areas of her life. Oh, hold that thought. Hi, Nicole. Welcome to the show. Nicole?
Hi, can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Okay, great. I'm calling because, okay, I call what happened on Monday morning is my battle with the blueberry muffin.
Blueberry muffin. Okay, what was this battle?
I really had this battle with this muffin. So the day before, we had gone to, like, Coffee Bean and bought some pastries, and we took them to my boyfriend's office, and he gave them to the people there, and he's like, okay, babe, like, which one do you want to keep for yourself? And I said, okay, the blueberry muffin. We'll keep, and we kept an almond croissant for his mom. Anyways, we put it in his lunchbox, and then I just told him before we went to bed, like, oh, make sure you take the blueberry muffin and make sure you take the pastries out so that they don't go bad. And so anyways, he left it on the counter. I woke up in the morning, and the blueberry muffin was there, and I didn't want it, but I'm like, okay, I should eat it so that it's not anticipation of deprivation.
That's a good one, Nicole.
I struggled with this for an hour and a half, okay. Dr. Nina. I wasted an hour and a half of my morning going back and forth on whether or not I was going to eat this blueberry muffin. And it was just a little crazy because I was like, well, why am I telling myself not to have it? I really don't want it, but maybe I should just eat it so I don't, like, feel like I'm not giving myself it. Anyways, do you get it?
I think what you're saying is although you did not actually want the blueberry muffin, there was a part of you that thought you should eat it just in case you did want it and were sort of unknowingly depriving yourself. I think I understand.
Yeah, kind of. I think that was it. And then I was like, okay, well, I'll walk to Blue Bottle and I'll get a coffee, and then I'll come back and I'll just have a little bit of the blueberry muffin, and then I'll just enjoy it with my coffee. And then I'm like, but I really don't want it. I'd rather have like yogurt and berries. But then it was like this mind trick where I was like, well, why don't I just have a blueberry muffin?
So the idea
is crazy. So yeah, I ended up having some of it, by the way.
Okay. The idea of eating more intuitively or not being deprived is the idea of choice, so that you can say, you know what, I can have, there's that blueberry muffin, I could have it, but what I really want is yogurt and berries. And you get more in touch with what you want rather than what you should or shouldn't have. So getting more in touch with what is your body wanting rather than what are some rules you should go by or break. So in this case, you're almost like using my rule of don't deprive yourself to create this battle in your mind. And we talked a couple of weeks ago, and I put it out there, like, what are your rules around food?
Yeah.
And so it almost sounds like you were trying to kind of go by the rule, don't deprive yourself, but you forgot the most important rule, which is you get to decide.
Intuitive.
You get to decide. You can always have a blueberry muffin, but what do you want? Because when you say, I can never have a blueberry muffin, so I'm just going to have it this once, and then I'm going to go on my plan, and then I'm going to
diet,
you know.
Yeah.
But as opposed to, you can have it any time, what do I want?
You hit the nail on the head. Yeah. Because you're right. I'm thinking too much about rules, and I'm trying to almost replace the rules I have from my nutritionist back when I was 16 with the quote unquote rules that you kind of had taught me, but they're not rules. Like, first and foremost, it's be intuitive, listen to your body. What does your body want? Give your body what it wants. Whether it's fat, carbs, protein, listen to your body.
Oh my God.
Then,
wait.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. Yes, Nicole. Yes.
Okay.
Yes, that's it.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And then secondary is don't deprive yourself. If you want something that quote unquote you would have called bad before, but your body wants it and you're craving it, have it, enjoy it, don't feel guilty about it. And you can always have it again the next day. And what's so funny is when I told my boyfriend about how I had this battle with the blueberry muffin, he's like, why didn't you call me? I'm like, what would you have done? He's like, I would have told you to eat the whole thing. And then I was like, yeah, maybe I should have called you.
Well, you see,
I don't know.
And I'm sure it didn't even occur to you to call him.
No.
Never. So here's this person who says, hey, turn to me. You don't have to have this struggle by yourself. And he's a safe, he seems to be, the more I hear about him, he seems to be a very safe person. And interested in being there for you and understanding you and all of those things, as opposed to judging you. When, again, you have the mother who says dirt should be over her head because she ate a blueberry muffin or she's got to starve herself.
Yeah.
Then you learn, hey, you got to avoid people and go by their rules.
Yeah.
As opposed to turning to them.
No, you're right. And I think I need to remember that he is there for me and that I can turn to him. And I'm so lucky and grateful to have someone who, like, we call it partner support, who, like, supports me. Like, I have partner support. Like, I can always call him and he's there for me and he won't, like, he loves me and will give to me and, like, hold my hand and not judge me and not, like, leave me because I have certain issues like we all do.
Exactly.
That's a really good point.
And if you were listening to Dr. Edwards and talking about perfectionism and control and shame, I mean, all of those things are kind of in play as far as your history go. I hear this weird sound that almost sounds like a wave.
Oh, sorry. Do you still hear the wave?
No. Okay. That this idea that you, because you were shamed for eating, because you were shamed for what you weighed, you learn. Now I hear it again. Okay, I'm just gonna keep going.
I think it might be the cars, because I walked out of the office
Okay.
And I'm trying to think where I can go
traffic.
That's more quiet. Let me go in like a parking, outdoor parking. Okay.
Yeah, Ronan is writing traffic. Thanks, Ronan.
Thanks, Ronan. Confirmed.
So when you are shamed, when you are shamed for those things, you learn to associate people with shame, not with support, not with partner support. Mm-hmm. You learn it. Mm-hmm. You learn, like, you gotta appear perfect, and you've gotta dodge everything that looks like imperfect, and you can't struggle.
Yeah.
And you've got to do, as opposed to partner support means, hey, we're here for each other, and it's not about being perfect. That it's not about some facade. It's about who are you and what are you dealing with, not what do you look like and how are you living your life, and you don't have problems and blah blah blah, which is totally unrealistic.
Yeah, it's so true. And I think that the last guy I dated, which I talked to you about on the show, a few weeks back, was he perpetuated the idea of perfectionism, and he made himself seem like, oh, I'm so perfect, oh, I have no problems, and was this kind of like narcissist doctor that thought that like he shouldn't go to therapy and he shouldn't work on himself, and like there's nothing wrong with him and he has no problems and everything should be perfect 100% of the time, and if they're not, then like he doesn't want anything to do with it, and like that's not freaking reality.
That is not freaking reality. And he did you a big favor by breaking up with you, albeit abruptly, which was very hurtful. That's not reality, and that's not living is a whole range of experiences, right? Saying you can't appreciate the hills without the valleys. You can't appreciate the valleys without the hills. You have to have good and not so good things, bad things, all a range of experiences to appreciate when things are going well.
Yeah, and I would have never met this amazing person, real, genuine, like supportive, loving, kind, communicative, growthful person if it wasn't for the other perfectionist weirdo.
Yeah.
Sorry, didn't mean to say that.
Oh no, the perfectionist weirdo. That sounds like a very generous way to put it. But his loss, because he's gonna live a miserable life pretending to be happy, and you're gonna live an authentic life, and you're gonna soon be free of the battle of the blueberry muffins. And may I also say that it is significant that you let him know about that. That also struck me. You told him that you had a battle with the blueberry muffin.
Oh, I told him. He walked in and I was like, he's like, what happened? He said something and I said, babe, like he's like, oh, what happened? Did you see the blueberry muffin I left for you or something? And I said, yeah, I had an hour and a half battle with it this morning. And then he started laughing, and then I told him, and that's when he's like, why didn't you call me?
Yeah, so. He's truly there for you, and you're trusting him more, and that is wonderful. So I'm so happy to hear this, and, I want you to think about those rules, and let's identify some of those rules. It has to come from within, not from without.
Yeah, wait, before we hang up, because I know that we have to go, can I just ask, what should I have done with the blueberry muffin? Should I have just said, well, I don't want the blueberry muffin, let me put it in the refrigerator, and if I feel like eating it later, I will have some of it.
Perfect.
Okay.
You took the words out of my mouth. Exactly. Perfect.
Okay, I love it. And then I'm going to throw it away, but then I was like, why should I throw it away? That's a waste. I was going to throw it away so I don't even have to do the battle. But why throw it away? Just put it in the refrigerator. Say, if I feel like having it later, I'll have it later.
That is, it does not get better than that. That is the perfect response. Good for you, Nicole. I'm really proud of you.
Okay.
Keep
thank
me posted.
Thank you.
Okay.
Okay, talk to you soon.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Oh, the battle of the blueberry muffin. I think she has won the war. She may have lost the battle a little bit, but she won the war. And that is our show for today. Thank you so much for joining me here on the Dr. Nina Show on LA Talk Radio. I am so happy to spend this hour with you. If you like the show, can you take a couple of moments and rate it? If you're listening to it on Apple Podcasts, take a moment and rate the show, because the more ratings and reviews that we get, the more it shows up in searches, the more I can help people also liberate themselves and have a healthier, happier relationship with food. So stay kind to yourself, and I will see you next week. Bye for now.
You're listening to the Dr. Nina Show with Dr. Nina Savelle-Rocklin, only on LA Talk Radio.